In this explosive episode of Eyes Wide Open, I'm speaking to cutting-edge investigative journalist Johnny Vedmore. In addition to his groundbreaking research and fearless journalism, Johnny is the founder of Newspace.com and host of the Newspace podcast. He's also a talented songwriter and musician. Johnny has gone where other journalists fear to tread, put in some serious hard work to connect the dots, and left no stone unturned in his pursuit of the truth. Not only do we get a deep dive into Epstein and his connections with the Alphabet agencies, but we also uncover an alternative American history and discover who really runs the US. If you've got the stomach for more shocking truth bombs, you're gonna love this. Johnny Vedmore in the house. Wow, what a privilege. The star of the moment, the man at the midst of all the controversies going on right now. Thanks for coming in, Johnny.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here. It's amazing to come down to a proper studio. I'm used to being on Zoom and doing all of that stuff. Yeah. And you know how it is in the UK. We don't really have the infrastructure like this.
It is because, you know, That's one thing is you know, with the Zooms, they're great. I know I enjoy them. We can get quite deep on them, but there isn't the personal touch that you get face-to-face, and there's so much more that you can communicate in a face-to-face setting. So, yeah, thanks for coming in. I appreciate you traveling over from Cardiff. We had a little meet-up in Cardiff a few weeks ago, which was a pleasure to see your local and get a little drink in the pub. That was cool.
Yeah, it's a nice place, Cardiff, and it's always a place that you can bring people and they feel at ease, they feel peace. It's like a chilled place. I love it.
So the reason, you know, which we're talking is because of the impact that your work is having on popular culture. You know, you're right in at the deep end in some of the most controversial and important topics of the day. Just wanted to have the opportunity to be able to talk to you about your work, your research, your writing. Tell me a little bit about how you've become and are developing into this freewheeling, maverick, independent journalist.
Oh, God, what a terrible tale that is. For most people, when they tell it, their life story, it kind of like goes, well, I failed lots of bad things happened to me. I kept getting, you know, a lot of weight on my back, monkeys on my shoulders, you know, that weighed me down through life. I had like experience of like being groomed when I was young. There was violence in my family, all of these type of things happened. You know, there was no support structure. We're in Britain and Britain was being cut during all when I was born in 1980. So like through the 80s, you had Thatcher and then you had Major and it's just cut, cut, cut. And then you have New Labour and it's cut, 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 cut all the time. So there was no support structure there for people. And like, I ended up suffering from severe anxiety. You know, I worked in hotels for a lot of my life. I was a musician. I was playing all of the time and it was really good for me to hide away in a little box, in a little room and sort of like take lots of drugs and get off my head and just get away from it all. And I did a load of that to kind of get. And I also had like a thing called Graves' disease, really complicated, like sort of hyperthyroidism. I went down to 8.5 stone at one point when I was 27. When I was at my peak of what I should be like, oh, my peak healthiness as a man on earth, as a human being on earth, I was like at my illest. I was at 8.5 stone and I was like unable to do anything. And at the same time, you're living in a society where you're frowned upon if you phone in one day sick from work. So I was going into work and killing myself for no one, you know, for no love, for no, and everybody who's out there in Britain, America, wherever they are in the world, who out there going every day, work over and over again, and they often get no love. Once they get to the hardest points in their life, you know, they've often got no support and everything starts to fall away. And I, you know, I had a lot of that. So I had a lot of struggle, I'd say. And by 2015, I kind of made a decision. It was either something new or it was the end of it.
Well, you seem to have found your calling, because now 43, three years younger than me, you found your calling.
Don't tell people.
As this cutting edge journalist and writer, and your writing is really good. It's great to see you come of age. You are tackling some of the most controversial subjects, the most risky, dangerous subjects to individuals like yourself, because, you know, you're exposing very powerful people doing very bad things. And I think your work on Epstein and Maxwell and Wexner, you know, is going to go down in history. I don't think that's hyperbole to say that. I think it's some really, really important work. It's not just Epstein and Maxwell connection that you've developed, but lots of other strands to your incredible research in exposing some of these most heinous criminals in our society today. And I want to kind of start on your story of exposing this guy I'd never heard of before called Stanley Pottinger, an alternative Jeffrey Epstein, who was also connected to Epstein and the CIA and all of these incredible links. Tell us a little bit about how you came to discover Pottinger and why he's important.
Yeah, you said loads of really kind stuff about me there. Thank you. I hope that I'm doing the best I can. And I kind of work between the lines of what everybody else is working on. I started to work out very early, and this leads to Pottinger. You know, people will all be looking at what's trending, what can possibly get them clicks, what can get them views, but they're not looking for what's new or what's original, what's between the lines. And Pottinger is very much between the lines. I've been researching Epstein case, the Epstein case since about 2019, and I've worked with some of the best in the field, and I've discovered a lot over the past few years about myself through looking at that case as well. And I ended up, I mean, it's got to a point where I was, by about 2021, 2022, I was starting to talk with victims and other people involved in the case and start to realize that not everything is what it seems. The place I started with Epstein was looking into a woman called Nicole Yunkerman, who no one else had looked into. And that led me down this path then of trying to find the people no one else in the areas no one else was were looking at. And it's actually quite a lot of areas where people aren't looking at in the Epstein case, because the Epstein case is this incredible, vast treasure trove of investigations, you know. A lot of the work that's been done on the Epstein case is just like removed the topsoil, and you see the network underneath and what they're doing. It's all loads of different activities. He's a high-level fixer doing high-level stuff. And in meeting all of these different people, I started to get dragged in to what I see as a massive operation. And I started to see the operation from kind of within the operation. I started to see how people were trying to manipulate me, and people were trying to get me to say certain things. And I'd already had enough experience to be a bit wiser than that. And that led me to question just one victim in particular, a woman called Maria Farmer, who claims to have been molested by Epstein and Maxwell when she was about 23, 24.
Bit old for Epstein.
Yeah. He said that, you know, if they were 18, they were too old for him. So, I mean, he was a sadistic preferential paedophile. He's not interested in older women. But also, you know, I had met Maria Farmer separately. I thought she was a hero. I thought she was one of the best things ever. I listened to all her stories and I believed everything she said. And when cracks started to appear in this, and it really got confusing, so I had to investigate. And that led me to finding a few different things. There was a few people already who had been, victimized by Maria Farmer, who had been targeted by Maria Farmer, who had come to me already and said, I've had this experience, I've got all of these different stories I can tell you. And I basically, we set up a kind of like a surviving Maria Farmer group, because she was being very abusive to a wide range of people openly. So it's hard for her to deny this. You know, all the evidence is out there, many tweets.
And she was claimed to be a victim of Epstein and was at the forefront of victims claiming against the Epstein and Maxwell.
Her affidavit, the first affidavit she entered about her experience with Epstein, the molestation and working for Epstein on the door and letting in Alan Dershowitz to the New York buildings that Epstein had, that happened in 2019. 19. So that was just before, that was, I think it was about April. And that was like a few months before Epstein would be arrested in 2019. It was very late in the game, but there's a whole backstory that's very complicated. I don't really want to go into, but what it did, it led me to realize that in 2017, 18, 19, Maria Farmer was listed as working for this antitrust fraud company with alongside a guy called John Stanley Pottinger and some other very high up legal people, and it didn't make any sense. It was before she's entered in her affidavit. She's claiming she's working with the legal team. Pottinger is the legal like representative along with Edwards for a load of the Epstein victims. So she's working with him before, and then I started to see messages from before where she's basically having a relationship with Stanley Pottinger. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, who's Stanley Pottinger? Who is J. Stanley Pottinger? He makes no sense. And in investigating him, I discovered a completely, like an alternative American history. It rewrote American history. in following the line of, this person isn't telling the truth. I don't trust her. She's attacking me. What's going on? Investigate. And most people, what they do in the world, and this is where a lot of, for people who are investigating, that you can get angry with the person, the initial person. Everybody would say automatically, I should investigate Maria Farmer then and write an article about her. And then you're tit for tat going backwards and forwards with someone who's a probably like partial construct in the way she's acting, in her behavior at least, the outward behavior. But who's these other people behind her? Who's these people she connects? And J. Stanley Pottinger is one of the most important people in American history.
So he was the legal representative for a group of Epstein victims. He was leading that case.
Yeah, he approached Bradley Edwards, who's the main guy. Edwards Pottinger was the firm that represented people like Virginia Giuffre and others.
Who's the one who accused Prince Andrew?
Yeah. Pottinger approached Edwards in 2014 and was like, hey, you just after Virginia Giuffre had come back to America after being interviewed in 2013, late for 2013 by the FBI in Australia. She come back to America to fight for justice, and she meets up with Bradley Edwards. And the day she meets up with Bradley Edwards, in the nighttime, he gets a phone call from J. Stanley Pottinger, who's saying, hi, you might not know who I am, but I'm J. Stanley Pottinger, and I was this, that, the other, Department of Justice. I was all of these different things, and I can help you out with this Epstein thing. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want you to take the lead. And soon they created Edwards Pottinger Law Firm, and Pottinger... So who is he? Who is he?
International man of mystery.
Wonderfully interesting. I went all the way back to his father first, John Pottinger Sr. I think John Paul Pottinger, I think his name is. He ran John Pottinger Insurance Company in Dayton, Ohio, and was a city commissioner in Dayton, Ohio. He was actually, the interesting fact, fourth city commissioner in a row to die while in office in Dayton, Ohio. So city commissioners it was a dangerous job, obviously, to be in. It must have been a dangerous job. He was Bohemian Grove. He was 32nd or 33rd degree Mason because he was Scottish Rites. He was really big on the scene. He was involved in every club. And he had three sons, and two of them, J. Stanley Pottinger and David Forbes Pottinger, extremely interesting people. Of course, J. Stanley Pottinger is a little bit younger than his older brother, David Forbes Pottinger. And David Forbes Pottinger, I mean, when I was writing the book, I go back, I discovered about, oh, his dad's this interesting guy who's linked with all of these famous clubs and etc. Oh, well, let's go a little bit forward. Oh, his brother. What happens to his brother? Oh, 1962, his brother goes missing. And they find only a shoe and a T-shirt and a few beer cans outside his car. What's going on? Oh, my God. And then he gets found in a ditch with amnesia. And none of it made any sense. He had a runoff with the 17-year-old babysitter, Sherry van der Weyl, who had gone missing 4 days afterwards as well. He had taken her to trafficked her across state lines, child trafficking, as Stanley Pottinger's brother, took her on a ship if you know what I mean, a euphemism there, around Hawaii. And they spent, 6 weeks sailing about before they ran out of most of the money. He sold the ship and then they went back. He pretended that he got beaten up and found in a ditch, and she came back a little bit later. He was arrested, of course, and then he was given like a slap on the wrist, seemed a little bit protected. So it was a really interesting time. By this time, their father had already died. Their father died in 1958 when John Stanley Pottinger had gone to started going to Harvard University. And Harvard University during this period is one of the most interesting places you can possibly be. If you're a young man who's extremely talented, they will find you the thing you're going to do in the future. They will fit that in. This is a time of Brzezinski. This is a time of Henry Kissinger, running Henry Kissinger's international seminar, training up people like Klaus Schwab eventually, and all these young leaders were all being brought out.
Groomed.
Yeah, groomed through Harvard programs and projects. Same year that his future girlfriend would start a CIA program based at Harvard, Gloria Steinem, J. Stanley Pottinger started, and then 4 years later, after completing a degree in government, his brother goes missing and found in a ditch and all of that stuff happens. What really is interesting is when J. Stanley Pottinger gets into government, he's already quite big on the Republican scene. He's, you know, involved in 1967 with electoral stuff. He's working for Broad Currie Schultz, who are a law firm where he'll try only one case during that time, like a 4 or 5 year period. And then he gets brought into the Nixon administration. He's originally at the Department of Health, Education and Welfare, Department of Civil Rights. And then he eventually goes over to the Department of Justice and he's an assistant attorney general. During the first period in government, 1970 to 1973, he doesn't do much. It's all civil rights stuff. But from 1973 onwards, the things that happen in J. Stanley Pottinger's life and the things he does are incredible, which includes he is the man who signs off Watergate. He signs off the investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King. He signs off the Kent State Massacre investigation, finding that no, of course there was no order to fire. Later on, they find a tape where they say, oh, there's an order to fire on there. And he's like, well, I don't know about that. Well, of course he knew about that because he's the man who covers up. He was a cover-up man. He was heavily involved in the response to the Rise Up of Wounded Knee, the standoff Wounded Knee between this corrupt reservation leader, Wilson, and members of AIM. And all of the people who stood up against this corrupt leader got basically harassed by different members of federal government for 2 years. Then he was heavily involved in Orlando Letelier. When Orlando Letelier was assassinated in 1976 on Embassy Row in Washington, he had been in the government. A foreign minister at one point in the Allende government before Pinochet had been taken over in a CIA-fronted coup. Chile and a few other states assassinated Orlando Letelier on American soil. An investigation started. A man called Eugene Proper was put in charge of the investigation. The first person he goes to is Stanley Pottinger, and Stanley Pottinger takes him to go see George H.W. Bush, and George H.W. Bush is the director of the CIA, and they all sit in a room, and George H.W. Bush says, well, if you can get us, you know, some sort of right to spy domestically on U.S. citizens, then we'll be able to solve your problem about all of this sort of stuff and Operation Condor.
Because this comes up a lot at the moment in my research as well. It's like Operation Condor just seems to emerge all the time as like a key moment in the intelligence services history and their ability to, you know, project their power internationally so that they get themselves off the hook. You know, what's your take on Operation Condor and how it fits into this story?
It's a spot on. Operation Condor was, for people who don't know, a South American mixed nation operation. So Chile, I think Argentina, a few other of the South American states all basically carried out sanctions against targets on foreign soil. So in Orlando Letelier's case, he had been Chilean. Pinochet wanted to get rid of him. So they had multiple countries work at the operation to take him down, so that once the Americans turn around and say, well, who killed this person, and start investigating, they discover, oh, it's this person from this country, and this country, and this country, and this country. And suddenly you can't hold five separate countries responsible for the legal apparatus that's available for you internationally. So it means that you get off the hook. Like you say, you avoid accountability. And that's exactly what the security services have used in many ways, including CIA and Mossad, who will like do operations where they're kind of like merging in and out.
As we understand the Epstein case, we believe it to be a Mossad operation, that he was an agent of Mossad. He was compromising powerful American, British politicians, industrialists, in order for them to do what they wanted for Mossad intelligence. But Pottinger wasn't Mossad. Was he American based? And how does that relationship work?
Yeah. Jeffrey Epstein had links with Mossad because he was obviously, and this has to be said, right, this is from my research and this is my opinion, but it's not the most popular opinion when you actually get into the researchers, because a lot of people are pushing out the Mossad line and I don't believe it. The evidence always leads back to the CIA, and he seems to be running the East Coast for the CIA. So Mossad people who want to do anything on the East Coast have got to go to Epstein and get permission from the king to do that on their territory.
So he was the gatekeeper for Mossad on the East Coast of America?
Not only for Mossad, he's a gatekeeper for nearly all CIA intelligence operations.
Right, okay.
So the fact is, people are trying to give this image that he's just running sexual compromise operations. He's meeting with really extremely high-level operatives who are obviously now,
neocon CIA operatives?
Yeah, CIA operatives hide under all guises and all ideologies. The CIA is recruiting more and more. The growth of intelligence infrastructure is just going up exponentially. Everybody says, oh, he was just this or just that. But there's so many this, that. What, financier, he's a real estate, he's into this, he's a scientist, he's everything. He's doing everything all the time. It does not make sense. No, he's involved in everything because he's the guy who gets everybody to do their bits. He's the guy who organizes. He's the guy who coordinates. He's the guy who links. He's the guy who says, yeah, I'll find out if you can do that for my guys, who are the Central Intelligence Agency. And if people label him as mainly Mossad, or, oh, he was only working for Mossad, what difference does that make? It stops people straight away from holding the CIA accountable.
But is that where Operation Condor can be applied to that situation?
Exactly, yeah. So there's two intelligence networks running, and every time that you want to spy domestically or carry out intelligence operations domestically on either one of these countries, say, probably you could say about the Five Eyes. And Israel, they basically help each other out. They've become the same, they've become tentacles of the same octopus.
So MI6 would spy on USA, and MI6 would then give that information to CIA.
You wouldn't even have to do much of that. You just have like a CIA spying on American soil, which is the main problem, or British spying on Britain, and then blaming the Americans for doing it, or blaming
so
the things. You just have to say, oh, look, that person who did that has links to Mossad. So it means it was Israel who was doing it, wasn't it? Because it's links to Mossad.
So this Pottinger character seems to stride over things like Operation Condor and all of these kind of CIA operations.
He's developing them. I think they saw in Operation Condor a brilliant way to avoid accountability in the future. The reason why George H.W. Bush was so desperate to learn more about Operation Condor was that they would be able to use that. And what happens just after that period, 1976, Pottinger sorts out this with Eugene Proper and George H.W. Bush in a meeting in CIA Central, 1977, Carter gets in. Pottinger is a Republican. He's been in two Republican administrations. He's been in Nixon and Ford. Carter gets in. He's allowed to stay in to finish covering up Watergate, because, of course, that's exactly what you'd allow Pottinger to stay on for. So he stays on for a special advisor through part of 1977, goes off then, works for some amazing cases, including one against the king of blackmail, Occidental Petroleum's Armand Hammer. The king of the blackmailers gets taken on and destroyed by Pottinger. And there's this story about how Armand Hammer's, there's brought up apparently in court where Armand Hammer's on his knees with two KGB agents in a hotel in Russia, and gets, someone walks in on him, and Pottinger's telling this story to people. So there's like this, like this time where he's doing these really interesting other things. But what happens just afterwards? In 1980, he starts defending Gerald Bull with the space research stuff, which is illegal arms smuggling to South Africa while it's got apartheid regime and it's got sanctions on there. And so he's defending Gerald Bull. In the same year, he is involved with smuggling weapons to Iran. Pottinger himself arranges with one of his clients of his law firm and business partner, because he had $100,000 in this guy's bank, Cyrus Hashemi. Cyrus Hashemi and his brother Jamshid Hashemi had a really terrible reputation for being extremely naughty boys. And Pottinger basically, and Cyrus Hashemi offered themselves to the CIA, to the American infrastructure, to get the release of the hostages in Iran during the Iranian embassy siege, but at the same time use it to mold the October surprise, which would see Ronald Reagan and Pottinger's mate George H.W. Bush take office and supply arms to Iran with deals in the background. Or if you do this and hold those hostages...
Is that all the key events in modern history,
isn't it? And that event cannot be understated how central he is to Iran-Contra and how important that is to see. Because that's Pottinger when he's just balls out CIA running guns. And who else is involved in that? Who starts funding it right at the beginning? It's in One Nation Under Blackmail. Jeffrey Epstein's there financing parts of Iran-Contra, where he's pushing on Adnan Khashoggi, who's also doing arms smuggling, who's in business with Cyrus Hashemi.
Would you say that's the beginning of Epstein's relationship with Pottinger? Mm. Is that during the Iran arms Contra?
They may have met sometime before. That's very likely. There's very likely that there's a lot of parties these guys are attending together. But there's 2 points. And number one, Pottinger himself later admits to Bradley Edwards, written in Relentless Pursuit, Bradley Edwards' book, he says, you know, Pottinger admits to him that he shared an office with Jeffrey Epstein in the early 80s. And this is during the period when he's running guns in the same program as Jeffrey Epstein for the CIA. Jeffrey Epstein for the CIA. Stanley Pottinger for the CIA. Cyrus Hashemi and Adnan Khashoggi both it doesn't end well for them. No. You know, after 6-7 years, I think it was 1986 where Cyrus Hashemi dies of a very fast acting leukemia, which was obviously something to do with
Russian poison.
working with the CIA. But what's even worse for Pottinger is in 1984, all of this is exposed because the FBI was so suspicious of what was going on, and they didn't know what the CIA was doing, and they didn't know about the October surprise, and they wouldn't have agreed with the October surprise because, of course, you know, it's one side. It's about the Republicans gaining office. By 1984, the FBI revealed that they wiretapped Cyrus Hashemi's office and been listening to all Pottinger's conversations with him, and were considering indicting him.
Indicting Pottinger?
Yeah, and Rudy Giuliani comes along and says, "Oh well, we're looking at him, and we'll
as the New York mayor."
No, but when he was
DA.
He was an attorney. Yeah, yeah. Or he was an. I don't know if he was.
He was a district attorney in New York because he brought down the mafia.
Basically, he moves off to Mexico really quickly. Pottinger goes, hides out, 1984, 1985. His relationship with the CIA darling, Gloria Steinem, ends in 1984. She runs off with industrialist Mort Zuckerman. But he had gone out with that CIA lovey since 1974 to 1984. That was 10 years where she, before she had run loads of various different CIA operations and admitted to being working for the CIA, knowingly working for the CIA, and said, oh, well, it's just, you know, we were only doing good things. I've never seen them do anything bad. So, you know, she was just like off in a, of this elite that believes the CIA were only doing good things, but they really, they were in it for themselves, for their own financial gain. Because during this period as well, and this is what really should be questioned, because this is where the kicker is, Stanley Pottinger during this period is making the bulk of his money. He's claiming it's an investment banking. At the same time, he's smuggling guns and causing political coups of America. I mean, the October surprise caused a coup. That's a coup. That was Reagan and George H.W. Bush taking power, probably less Reagan, who's like walking around, and George H.W. Bush. So it's probably more George H.W. Bush. Just that was more the takeover of the CIA. And it leads to a question. Since JFK got shot in the head, when have the CIA not been in charge of America?
You know, George Bush was the beginning of this entire crime spree we've seen, you know, right through all of the presidents, maybe with the exception of Trump, but all of the others seem to be well connected through the whole Bush crime family. You can connect them all.
Yeah.
So that was the coup when the CIA took power in America. Well, this dynasty, if you like, were the ones that, you know, took over from whoever was running it before them.
Yeah. And really, it was, obviously, the CIA, the history of the CIA and the rise of the CIA really just coalesces, coincides with the rise of the CFR and the Council on Foreign Relations. And obviously linked in some way. When the CFR does something, the CIA or their hand, especially through the 60s and 70s. This changes later on in certain aspects, like color revolutions. It becomes the CIA's old jobs that they used to get in trouble for.
So the economic hitman through John Perkins' stuff.
That job got taken over by things like National Endowment for Democracy, USAID, and all these
NGOs. But that's clever the way they did that, because they didn't want the CIA to be obviously the ones that were conducting these coups in these countries, you know, using World Bank's money to enslave them through debt. So they got corporations in front of the CIA to go in and, you know, get them to take these enormous loans that they would give to American companies to do the work. But the reality was, behind the scenes, the CIA were pulling the strings.
Yes,
because they first developed it in Iran.
There's a lot been developed in Iran. And it makes you ask questions about the real history, because when you research about Iran-Contra affair and the October surprise, what you discover is this strange world where the Iranians are really in bed with the Americans at a time when they're looking like they're not in bed with the Americans, you know? They are working with them for their own benefit. Like high-ranking members, people like Mandani, Pasandida, and other people.
Do you mean during the Shah's reign or after the revolution?
After the revolution, yeah. They're completely like, you know, they're on the same page. They just got to look like they're the characters.
Yeah.
Oh, we know what trope you're making of us, and we will happily continue with that trope, but behind the scenes, you're going to give us weapons and this and that and the other, and we know that it doesn't matter what other people think, because we don't care about these plebs anyway. It's like the World Economic Forum standing at Davos on top of the mountainside looking down. They can project themselves like they're Dr. Evils and stuff, and for us, we're like, oh, and for them, they're like, oh. You know, they love it. They love having that sort of feeling that they know
of being hated by the plebs.
Yeah, they know that we think they are the all-powerful beings on Earth, and they've got control.
If I'm going to have to hawk my words to keep the Eyes Wide Open lights on so I can keep dropping truth bombs for you, then I'm going to make damn sure that the stuff I do plug is the real deal. We all know that if something's good for your health, the criminal cabal will do their best to suppress it. And that's exactly what they did with ivermectin. But I've got proof that it not only works, but works wonders. When this fox first arrived in our garden, she was starving and horribly riddled with the mange. The mange torments foxes and drives them crazy. So we started feeding her and treating her with ivermectin. Her recovery was beyond remarkable. The mange is now gone and her tail is nice and bushy once again. We brought her back from the brink of death. The good news is you too can get your paws on this extraordinary anti-parasitic medicine that has a myriad of uses. You can get that from our sponsor, the Anti-Aging Store, link below. Even better, become a member of Eyes Wide Open and benefit from a 5% discount on all products at the Anti-Aging Store. Now that's a good deal. Keep bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, my friend. Now, back to the action.
But back to Pottinger. So we've got a really interesting character there, haven't we? Like almost like America's James Bond. Yeah, and he seems to be involved at all of these key moments in history. But how does that tie in to the Epstein case? Because, again, we began this story with you telling us that Pottinger became the representative for Epstein's victims, but yet you've also just said that they were working together during Iran-Contra. Is there any more to this story about the connection between Pottinger and Epstein, and how the hell did he end up as the lawyer for the victims of the trafficking?
Such a fantastic story. I mean, when you're researching an article and it writes itself, it does take a lot of research. I really mean it does take a lot of research. It took me a year to research all of the Pottinger series. Some of that was just like day after day.
Sorry to interrupt you, because that was something, as you were telling me that story then, about Pottinger, I was like, well, where are you getting this from? What are your sources? How are you able to piece together the life of this man of mystery, I guess, as being this high-level CIA operative that is involved in all of these key events? What were your methods to uncover this?
Really easy, same as every single time, and anybody can follow him, anybody at all. What you do is you go, say, for instance, to newspaper archives, and you source every single bit of information about every single year, and there's a lot of it out there for people who are constantly in the news and want to be publicized and want to have public faces. They're constantly in it. I found Pottinger, John Stanley Pottinger, mentioned from about 1954, when he's just a young kid, his face in the newspaper, onwards, loads of times, and then more. And it takes a long time to put then all that down, and then you go and you put in chronological order, and then you go to the next database or the next place where you're going to find or you're going to search. And then you put all that information and you wind it.
It's amazing that it's all on the public record, though, isn't it?
Yes, but it takes a load of time. And all it is placing every single source you can find about that person in chronological order and letting it tell its own story. Now, then you have to think about tangential. And this will come up. 1984 to 1986, Pottinger's hiding out in Mexico. Yeah, he's like, little sombrero, little mustache. I've mentioned this before. I was like, all right, I don't know what you mean, man. I don't know what you mean. Me. Then 1987, he returns and he gets public praise, becomes member of the Rockefeller,
brought back
Institute.
Into the fold.
Yeah. Big boys all giving him rewards, and he's got loads of money now. He's no longer, George H.W. Bush is in office. He's going to pardon everybody for Iran-Contra at the end of his time. So it's not even going to come back round to me. He doesn't have to worry, you know. Same with Watergate. I mean, Reagan was going to give everybody a free, get out of jail free card on that. And his name didn't come up, but he knew he was protected. So he's enjoying it. He comes back to America. He buys a house. 1989, he buys one house. He's like, oh, I'm going to buy a house in Twin Lakes Road in South Salem in New York, next to the lake. Beautiful lake house, really nice. Then in 1990, he goes and buys another house. Oh, this is so brilliant.
Pottinger.
Yeah, Pottinger goes buys a house in Palm Beach.
Palm Beach, haven't we heard that before? Who else do we know that lives in Palm Beach?
And I was researching, and I was like looking through all of his addresses. I had told someone, you know, Pottinger lived in Palm Beach. I haven't worked out a date, but do you know he lived in Palm Beach? And he turned around and just said, oh, yeah, but it was probably much later on. You know, people do that. Everybody knows El Brillo Way, 358 El Brillo Way, the nightmare house of Jeffrey Epstein, where the majority of underage girls were molested by Epstein himself and sometimes Maxwell.
So it wasn't even the island where most of it happened. It was...
Oh, no, because the island, it would be mainly the girls who would be brought over to the island were the select group.
Because that's the image in the popular culture, isn't it? That's all we can think of is this, you know, this weird island with this temple on there, but it all went on in Palm Beach in Florida.
The fact is that at Palm Beach, they were going to schools, parks, they were going to malls, they were recruiting girl after girl. He was having 2 to 3 massages a day. And if you class that, say, between 1994 and 2004, Epstein in his Palm Beach residence was having 2 to 3 massages a day, say, round it off to a 2.5 and then you times it by 10 years and every day in that time, you'd work out that he would have committed 8,000 plus offences by the end of it. So it was all going on then. Now, 1990, he hasn't bought this place yet. He buys it at the same time Stanley Pottinger is buying his house. And where's his house? Oh, it's 500 metres away from Jeffrey Epstein's house as a crow flies, bought in the same year, just a stone's throw.
So what are the implications of that? Other than the obvious, right? But what does that tell us? That they were business partners, they were working together, they were, you know, agents working as the CIA in partnership. Was Pottinger Epstein's handler? I mean, what's the relationship there? Why is it important that he lives 500 meters away from...
Wow, I haven't even considered the idea that Pottinger was Epstein's handler or Epstein was Pottinger's handler, but that would make a hell of a lot of sense. I mean, I'm sure if you looked into that theory that you might find some substance in it, because I've seen them, you know, at the moment, I'm still in there.
Someone had to be giving Epstein all his power. Someone had to be checking in on him that he was doing his job, whatever his job was.
But Palm Beach is a really powerful, this little run on Palm Beach. Yeah. I mean, if you go from where they are on really the one side of the billionaires like sort of area of Palm Beach, if you go far to the other side, you get to the Kennedy compound. It's been sold off afterwards. But Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is round Epstein's house all the time, mentioned by the gardener and stuff. So there's this whole like load of powerful people who are all linked and related and all... involved with each other's businesses, each other's lives. So what that means about them living 500 metres away might mean nothing at all. But seeing as they'd already apparently worked in an office together, which I think means runs guns and etc., and they'd already done all of the Iran-Contra stuff together, you'd think that if they're buying a house at the same time within 500 metres of each other, that's extremely interesting.
Do you think that Pottinger being the legal representative of Epstein's victims is a move by the CIA to keep the case under their control due to Pottinger's relationship to Epstein, possibly knowing everything that went on with Epstein? Is he there to corral the case? I mean, why is it important to this meta-narrative that Pottinger is involved?
I think you have to understand there was a previous time where Pottinger wasn't involved. In between, I mean, we can skip over this very quickly. In between that, with them buying a house together or houses nearby together in 1990 and 2005, Stanley Pottinger became a best-selling author of fictional novels and kind of rebranded himself as Stan Pottinger. Stan the man, you know, he's your friend. And nice Stan the man was writing these thrillers. So he was reforming his idea. But when his image. But when it got to the time when Epstein's first case came up, that, when we look back on it, and it's provable, in every stage, Epstein had infiltrated every stage. Every level, Epstein had infiltrated. Epstein's powerful employers, backers, friends had influenced the situation so much that no one wanted to prosecute him properly. They gave him a really easy time. 12 months, open door. He was allowed.
He went home at night, didn't he, or something?
On sometimes. He paid the jail to create like some form of non-governmental organization, non-profit sort of thing within the prison where he could go and make himself an employee and just do his normal work and etc. So, I mean, obviously he that case was completely infiltrated at every single level. The second case is no different. The second case, from 2014, it became clear that they were starting it up again. The reasons for that are harder to understand. But around 2014, by that time, Bradley Edwards, the guy who's taking on Virginia Giuffre, is going to be in a backwards and forwards with Jeffrey Epstein. I think he's already have got like a certain legal action with other people against Jeffrey Epstein going on before that. But basically, he ends up meeting with him in cafes and having conversations with him all the time. And there's this weird situation, you see, where Epstein basically infiltrated the defense team again, did exactly the same as the first time. Every single level got infiltrated by Epstein and his guys, but everybody was watching. And that was too much.
So was he becoming somewhat of a rogue agent? Because that's what I can't really fully square at the moment, you know, is the meme, did Epstein didn't kill himself. Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself. But he was killed, as far as we know, if we presume that he was killed and wasn't shipped off to some beach somewhere like in Tel Aviv. Why would such a high-value asset who knew, you know, where all the bodies were buried and was an important, integral part of whatever the operation was that he was at the centre of, why would they remove their own man? Or was it another faction within the CIA or the American establishment? You know, what was the benefit? One, to get rid of Epstein from the narrative, from the story, and two, to jail Maxwell. Why would they do that?
I think they got way too hot. There was something coming in the future. I personally have started to believe that it's one of the future presidential candidates and their links with Jeffrey Epstein. I think there may be a wider operation that I'll investigate fully, and I think everybody kind of knows it. Everybody already knows there's something going on. There's an entire, listen, isn't it? There's a change-up happening in this world. We are sitting here having this conversation, and it is unbelievable. Can you imagine 7-8 years ago sitting down in a place and having this conversation with cameras up, knowing we're going to have this conversation and it is going to go out online? There is a change coming. Yeah. The mainstream media is dead as a doornail, and they already knew this. Everything, these guys think tank, they run through, they gain, they put all of the theories of what potentially could happen in the future so that they own the future, so that they keep the future. And they've been in control of the mainstream media, and because of that, the mainstream narrative, for our entire existence so far, for the first time in history, in about 2015, 16, 17, the trust in the media went down to a minus 80% trust rating. As told to you by Edelman PR, the right-hand man, Richard Edelman of Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum. But it's true figures. They were panicking at the time. Yeah. They were saying, you know, we need to do something about this now.
Well, that's the reason for the censorship of the internet, isn't it? Because it's a freewheeling platform for people, like you've just said, to talk about these topics on an internet platform that can go all over the world. And it seems as if that's what they're trying to do, is strangle the internet.
They know they can't do it. They know they can't do it. Everybody talks about one day like some form of kill switch on the internet getting off, and that's very possible. There's only a certain number of mega servers that need to be taken down for the whole internet to go goodbye-bye, and for internet to 2.0 to be made up. Yeah, maybe that will happen. But what we have to see is that without some sort of nuclear option, the other more likely option is a co-opting of the media, which is going to take over from the mainstream media before the mainstream media has fallen. But the message of the mainstream media at the same time is becoming so fractured and...
Well, you can see that with like Tucker, can't you? Tucker's now left the mainstream media and has chosen Twitter as the platform for which to disseminate his investigations and, you know, his report. And he's having an overwhelming success. Incredible numbers. But he's kind of like, is he really alternative media? Because isn't Tucker's father also CIA?
He was going to go and work for a federal agency or CIA when he was younger. Well, maybe they wouldn't accept it, or maybe they did accept him, and maybe that's why he was able to get into the mainstream media. Because to get into the mainstream media in the first place, anybody knows it. If you're you and me, you're not getting into the mainstream media.
I came close and they kicked me out.
Yeah, I have BBC contact me and try and get me to work with them. But at the same time, they're printing articles. They won't say my name, but they'll show an image from my articles and say how it's conspiracy theory. You know, they're
losing the argument with that, because they've worn out that smear of conspiracy theory. It's quite desperate, really, that they're unable to engage us on a level of, you know, discussion and reason and logic and talking about the facts. They just literally just try to shut you up with conspiracy theory. But that is wearing thin now. More and more people are going, what conspiracy theory? Where? You know, and they'll go and listen to the person they're trying to defame and, you know, stop an audience from listening to. So I think, like you say, we're going through a transition. We're going through a transition from the legacy main media are clearly dying. And there's a move over to the internet. But they're not going to want the internet to be out of their reach and out of their control. So there's definitely going to be like a new media, like you're talking about that.
It's already here. It smells, it smells. I smell, like, I look at Redacted. I've been on Redacted. I look at Russell Brand. I look at Kim Iverson. I look at the way they advertise themselves. Like, Kim Iverson, she'll advertise herself as, like, looking basically like the mainstream media. It looks like, basically smells like it. But then it's like, you know, it's not, so they can say they're cool. But, okay, who's funding you? Who's funding you? I wouldn't mind seeing your funding. I wouldn't mind seeing your funding. If you're going to claim to be different than the rest of them, all right, show your funding. Because I think that's the state we're going to come to if we're going to trust people. Russell Brand up there being shown off by the Teal Media organization, this new Teal Media organization of Rumble. Rumble is Peter Thiel. I mean, Peter Thiel is the technocratic king of the future. He is an awful human being. The person who's the creator of Palantir. The thing that's named after something that's so corruptible and potential evil to enter into your mind and destroy you forever is the name of his company that he can basically get. They've got data points on nearly like thousands and thousands on nearly every human alive, and they're creating all the infrastructure for all the debate databases for all of the private security organizations and all of the police and all of these things will end up one system. It'll be these people. Russell Brand, so he's, what does he say? He's this shocked look on his face every time. Oh, on his videos. Shock. Look at this. This will destroy you. Same with Redact. This will kill you. Oh, the same
it's
thing.
Click face, isn't it? Yeah.
It is the worst thing that the dying mainstream media offer. It is the crappiest thing that they offer. And that's what the new neo mainstream media, as I'm starting to call them now, are offering you. It's the same, the dying embers of the mainstream media in a way to say, we're going to act like you can be visceral and horrible and scare you and scare tactics and use psychological, disturbing people psychologically to get your message into your head. Russell Brand wants you shocked, scared. He wants you shaking. He wants you to worry. He wants you to fear. And who's he working for? Who's funding you, Russell? Yeah, you got loads of money. Oh, you're up there, out on the technocratic stage, and who's taking over the world? The technocrats are taking over the world, aren't they? We know what's coming. The CIA, all of these people are building an infrastructure that's linked in with these exact technocratic infrastructure that's being created across the top by all of these big businesses and these people like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, who will act like your friend to your face and who will obviously not be doing good things for you behind closed doors and for society in our
whole. So how does the real alternative media find a voice within that field? Where does the real alternative media fit into that? How are we able to get our message through that?
I don't think you can. I think they are really setting up. We have to keep doing what we're doing, which is like I write long form articles. I source them up the wazoo, and I know that when I put them out, hardly anybody's going to read them. And in a year, people are going crazy for them. And then in 2 years, people are going really crazy because it takes time and it takes momentum. So you have to let people find
I know that feeling.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Our job is to show people the truth, and the truth is never ended. So we just keep trudging through it. And eventually people will look back in history and they'll say, oh, look at those people who tried to scare us and use psychological tropes to manipulate our mind and make us watch their channels. And then look at all of this honest information that gives us the truth, gives us a true understanding of what's really going on. And in a historical context and with the passage of time going by, people will be able to see the difference between what we're doing and what this fake, like I say, neo-MSM are doing, which are just, they're using the worst part of the MSM and they're doing it at hyper.
That's something you're quite passionate about.
Yeah.
Oh, man, it's great to see you in action.
I feel like I've been involved in this for long enough to have a right to say that not everything is as it seems. And my life for the past few years, and I won't go into this right now, but my life for the past few years has been a long string of people trying to infiltrate me to make me say certain things using every method you can possibly imagine. And that includes things that will scare people. So in the future, when I tell people what, you know, my experience, what I've had to go through to be able to tell the truth and to be able to produce articles like this, people will see that it takes a large part out of your life. It takes a lot of impoverishes as well. It makes you passionate about the people who are sitting there and ruling the roost without giving you anything in return. They're just taking your fear. They're manipulating your mind, and they just want your fear. And that will be, the money will just keep running, flowing to them. Who is funding you? That's all I say to all of those neo-mainstream, Kim Iverson, show who's funding you. Redacted, show who's funding you. Show who's funding you.
Okay, well, that was something we can return back to, I hope, in the future.
It's time to start, like, really just opening your eyes wide.
Okay, I think that's a perfect note to finish on. Kindly, Johnny has agreed to do a Q&A for half an hour with our members, and that'll be great. Me and you can take some questions from our audience. Be fantastic. Appreciate you doing that. Where can people find your incredible research and work? Tell us what your links are and how people can follow you.
Yeah, definitely. If you wanna see my work at the moment, there's two main places: newspaste.com. That's news and paste.
I love that name, News Paste.
I want it to be a place where I can put other people's works too, and I can help people to link with other people in the independent.
Bloggers can send stuff to you, can they?
Yeah,
as well?
Yeah. I really am not only welcoming. I have one-on-one conversations with a lot of writers and independent journalists who have no other place to put their work. Sometimes have ideas and thoughts that are not on the mainstream, not even allowed in the alternative media, and I want to give everybody like an ability to have a platform. So that's what I'm doing with Newspace, but it's also the central hub for my own articles, for some shows, so Newshound, where I go through the newspaper archives, Newspasty, where I do some funny
Newspasty.
Yeah. Newspace podcast is out there, and of course you can go to johnnyvedmore.com, and johnnyvedmore.com has kind of all the links and a load of the links to my previous articles on the drop down menu, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnnyvedmore. Like I say, if people want to contact me and have a conversation, or they think they have an article, or they think they have a story, or they want to get into this, or they want advice, they can contact me. I'm an actual person. I'm not a construct. So I'm willing to have a two-way conversation and one-to-one conversations all the time with brand new people, because I want to see this alternative and independent media flourish.
Fantastic. Absolutely incredible to speak to you. Your research is phenomenal. It's amazing how you're able to, you know, present this to the audience. And we're really grateful for what you're doing. Johnny Vedmore, thanks for coming on Eyes Wide Open.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Cheers.